Good afternoon. The time is 1:34, and I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belt's Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Friday, March 20th. Happy springtime, everyone. Members present are Senator Dunbar, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones and join me in welcoming our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Jude Augustine. We have six items on our agenda today. We have reordered the bills in an attempt to work with the sponsor's schedule. First up will be Senate Bill 35, Delivery Network Companies. Next will be Senate Bill 185, Insurance Rebates and Advertising. Up third, Senate Bill 252, Universal Commercial Code, Secured Transactions, Electronic Records. Following that will be Senate Bill 150, Net Metering. Fifth will be Senate Bill 180, LNG Import Facilities. And finally today will be Senate Bill 196, Behavioral Health Crisis Surcharge and Fund. Up first, we have Senate Bill 35. With us to present a brief recap of Senate Bill 35 is my staff, Ms. Bieber. Ms. Bieber, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman, and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Sabea Bieber, staff to Senator Bjorkman. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 35 today. For a recap, Senate Bill 35 ensures that drivers for delivery network companies and transportation network companies have protections and certain insurance coverage covered by the companies. In version H that is before you, a driver for a transportation network company will be covered by the company while they are logged in or engaged in a prearranged ride, and a courier for a delivery network company will be covered by the company while they are engaged in delivery services. This bill also ensures that private lines insurance will be unable to waive coverage while a courier is logged on to the digital network of a delivery network company. And additionally ensures that transportation and delivery network companies are not allowed to waive the coverage in case of an uninsured or underinsured driver causing any loss or injury in an accident. The definition for delivery services is also updated to begin when a courier accepts an offer and ends when the courier returns to where they accepted the order, when they arrive at home, or when the courier begins a personal task unrelated to an order.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bieber. Are there any questions? Seeing and hearing none, during our hearing on Wednesday of this week, we had a committee substitute that came in past the deadline, so it was held over until today. Members have that committee substitute in their packets, which was on the table during the last meeting. May I have a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 35, version 34-Lima Sierra 0330/H as in Homer, as a working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Object for purposes of explanation. Ms. Bieber, will you give us a run-through of the changes for version H from version I?
Section 1 has no changes. Section 2, undeleted, previously deleted language. Section 3 is a new section amending AS 2196-018B, making conforming changes and provides circumstances in which an insurer may provide or deny coverage. Section 4 is a new section amending AS 2196-018F, referring definitions for the section to the definitions made in AS 2823-180. Section 5 is renumbered. That was previously Section 3 of Version I. Section 6 is also renumbered, and it amends AS 2823-050A to require a company to maintain primary auto insurance while a courier is providing delivery services for a delivery network company and while a driver is logged into a digital network or engaged in a prearranged ride for a transportation network company. Section 7 is renumbered. It amends AS 2823-050B, making conforming changes and removing language stating coverage may be satisfied by the company or the driver or a combination of both. This additionally adds language that disallows a transportation network company from waiving uninsured or underinsured vehicle coverage. Section 8 is renumbered and amends AS 2823-050C, making conforming changes. Sections 9 through 11 are renumbered. Section 12 amends AS 2823060 to make conforming changes. Sections 13 through 16 are also renumbered. Section 17 amends AS 2823180, changing the definition of delivery services, beginning when a courier accepts an offer and ending when the courier returns to where they accepted the order, or when the courier arrives at home, or when the courier begins a personal task unrelated to an order. Section 18 is a new section and repeals AS 2823050D.
Very good. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Matt. Mr. Chair, on Section 18, can you remind us what that is exactly? What are we repealing?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, yes. Give me just 1 second. AS 2823050D currently in statute reads, if insurance maintained by a driver under B or C of this section has lapsed or does not provide the required coverage, insurance maintained by a transportation network company must provide the coverage required by this section, beginning with the first dollar of a claim, and the transportation network company insurer has the duty to defend that claim.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunbar.
And why are we repealing that section? Is it superfluous now under the other language of the bill, or?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I would have to get back to the committee. That one was one that was recommended by Ledge Legal, but I can't really remember the reason.
Sounds like it's a fallback for the lack of a kind of insurance that I think the bill mandates that they now carry. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
Yep. Very good. Are there any further questions about the proposed CS? Hearing and seeing none, CS for Senate Bill 55, version 0330/H, as in Homer, is adopted as the working document, especially considering I removed my objection, which you all heard, I'm sure. While reviewing the CS, we discovered a duplicative mandate for an insurance requirement that we had only intended to apply once. So we have crafted a very small, minor amendment to fix that error of duplication. May I have a motion, please?
Brief at ease.
Record. Back on the record here, Senate Labor and Commerce, the time is 1:43 p.m. We have accepted the CS as a working document, and I had just explained that we had discovered a duplicative mandate, and we had an amendment drafted to fix that error. May I have a motion, please?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move Amendment H1. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll object for purposes of explanation. Ms. Bieber.
We were informed of a duplicative insurance requirement on the primary automobile insurance, and the transportation network companies didn't have an issue with this language. This was already in statute technically. So we just put the transportation network back in front of company, so it only applies to transportation network companies.
Very good. Thank you. I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to the amendment? Hearing none, Amendment H1 is adopted. Public testimony was left open for Senate Bill 35, this item, during the last meeting. So we will now check to see if there is anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item. Seeing and hearing none at this time, I'll close public testimony. That brings Senate Bill 35 back before the committee. Is there any further committee discussion? Seeing and hearing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 35, version 34-Lima-Sierra-033-H, as in Homer, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 35, version 34-LS-0330-H, as in Homer, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. Next, we're going to take up Senate Bill 185, Insurance Rebates and Advertising. This is our third hearing on the bill. We last heard it on the 16th when we had a presentation and took invited and public testimony. We took invited testimony and adopted a committee substitute. Today, it is my intention to take public testimony and look to the will of the committee. With us, my staff, Savea Bieber, is here to give us a brief recap of the bill. Ms. Bieber, welcome back.
Thank you again, Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Savea Bieber, staff to Senator Bjorkman. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 185 today. SB 185 reaffirms the purpose of AS 2136, the Trade Practices and Frauds chapter, to regulate the business of insurance in Alaska consistent with federal law known as McCarran-Ferguson Act and Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, and to prohibit unfair methods of competition and deceptive practices. SB 185 modernizes Alaska's insurance laws by clarifying permissible rebate and discount practices, allowing health-related wellness incentives, banning misleading free insurance advertising, and granting the Division of Insurance rulemaking authority to implement these updates.
Thank you, Ms. Bieber. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, at this time I'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 185. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify to this item? Is there anyone online? Seeing and hearing none, at this time I'll close public testimony. That brings Senate Bill 185 back before the committee. Is there any committee discussion, questions, or comments? Seeing and hearing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 185, version 34-Lima-Sierra-0721-I, as an Iditarod, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Seeing and hearing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 185, version 34 LS0721/I, as in IGIAGIG, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. We're back on the record now. Next up is Senate Bill 252. With us to give us a brief recap of this bill, we have staff to the Honorable Senator Matt Clayman, Ms. Carly Dennis. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Ms. Dennis, please put yourself on the record and begin your brief recap of the bill.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, this is Carly Dennis, staff to Senator Clayman. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 252. The Uniform Commercial Code, or the UCC, is a set of rules governing the commercial transactions and has been adopted in nearly identical form by all 50 states. And Senate Bill 252 incorporates amendments to the UCC recommended by the Uniform Law Commission and the American Law Institute. Over 30 other states have adopted both the 2022 and the 2018 amendments, and it's critical that Alaska adopt these updates to keep our statutes aligned with the best practices used by the rest of the country. Aligning these amendments will promote commercial activity for emerging technologies and will provide a clear framework for Alaska's business community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dennis. Are there any questions for the staff to the bill sponsor? Also available for questions on this item is counsel to the Uniform Law Commission, Benjamin Orzeski. He is available by Teams. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Orzeski? Ms. Orzeski, thank you very much for being available today and for the great presentation last hearing. Seeing hearing no questions for Mr. Orzeski, at this time I'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 252. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 252? Seeing hearing none, we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 252. That brings this item back before the committee. Is there any committee discussion? Seeing, hearing no committee discussion, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 1. Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. Back on the record, the time is now 1:54 p.m. here in Belts Room 105. We are under the wishes of the committee for Senate Bill 252. May I have a motion, please?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to adopt Senate Bill 252, version 34-Lima Sierra 0294, / N, as in Inanna, as the working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. It's 1:55 p.m. Sometimes it's at Labor and Commerce, the third time's a charm. May I have a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 252, version 34-Lima Sierra 0294, /N, as in Inanna, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, Senate Bill 252, version 34-LS0294, /N, as in Nan Wallach, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. It's 1:58 now in Belts Room 105. Next up on the docket, batting cleanup for us today is Senate Bill 150. We have with us for a brief recap of this bill, all about net metering, Curtis Thayer from the Alaska Energy Authority. Mr. Thayer, please put yourself on the record and provide us with a brief recap of the bill. We do not have Mr. Thayer today. That is okay. So I'll provide a brief recap of the bill. Just for the folks watching at home and the hundreds of attendants in the room, net metering is all about folks being able to build generation on their home or property and then sell the excess electrons that they generate back to the grid. And the main point of contention on this bill is whether or not folks who generate that electricity should be able to sell it back on the grid for the full retail rate, which is the rate that they're billed for, or should it be some other lesser amount to account for some subsidization of their system as well as cost shifting. So we'll talk about that throughout today's hearing. Before we before we go to invited testimony, is there any committee discussion, thoughts, ideas, questions about the bill before we go to invited testimony? Okay, seeing none, we'll go right to some invited testifiers. First up is Mr. Ben May from Alaska Solar. Mr. May, thank you very much for joining us today. He has a brief presentation for us. He'll talk about, from his perspective of a solar company, about what net metering means to him and why. He likes this legislation. Mr. May, thank you for joining us here at Senate Labor and Commerce. Put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senators, for this opportunity. My name is Ben May. I'm the owner and founder of Alaska Solar and a longest-standing member of Alaska Solar Energy Industries Association. It's quite a mouthful. So I'm here for my company, my employees, but also for probably 5 to 7 other companies who also install solar around Alaska and their customers. And I would also say future customers, because residential customers don't really follow the law. They don't know exactly what's going on here. So they don't know what they're likely to get if they go to seek solar later. My company started in 2016. It was just me on the roof. For a couple years, that was the case, and eventually I built up employees. You know, it was 7 systems in the beginning per year. After a few years, it was 30 or 40 or 50. We've grown to the point where we're doing residential installs, commercial installs, utility scale installs. Last year, we had about 110 installs, about 17, even more employees during the summer months, back down to 10 during the winter. So, the solar industry has grown. I was lucky enough to start when solar panels were cheap or had gotten cheaper by like 80%. And so it meant that I could have a business because people could put solar on their roof and it would meet or beat the stock market. That meant that people were willing to do it. And when we're talking to somebody of modest income, they're not going to throw away their savings. They need that savings to work for them. And so I found that the only way people were going to do it was if it was a good financial investment for them. And so that's one of the reasons I'm coming here, is to talk about that that factor and what happens in the marketplace as you try to work with people to go solar that maybe want to. So let's see. As I watched what's been going on lately in the back and forth about the bill, it seemed to me that what had started a year and a half ago when this bill was introduced was maybe not being emphasized as much. And I think the purpose of the bill, as Curtis there said pretty well in the last presentation, was to diversify energy sources, allow people to save money, and to provide, again, affordability. So I really want to hit the affordability part. When we install solar on someone's roof, the levelized cost of energy is about 15 cents a kilowatt hour. What does that mean? They put the money up front. It produces for about 25 years. What do they pay for that capital? It's about 15 cents. Customers right now are paying, it just went up a bunch, between 22 and 30 cents per kilowatt hour on the rail belt. So having solar gives people a choice. Do I have to pay this regulated monopoly, which is good, but they have another choice, which is to make power on their own roof, on their own house, or in their own yard, and to take care of their family better that way, basically. The original net metering bill in 2010, when it came in, really came to be because a group of engineers got together and argued with the RCA that, for God's sake, we're Alaskans. We should have the right to make power in our own homes. We should not limit that. And so that has carried a lot of weight, I think, for many people going forward. So, to also talk about affordability. When you put the capital in and you get that 15 cents kilowatt hour, now you are not going to pay anything more than that. Utilities do this with their capital investments. They try to get things leveled out as much as possible. For a customer, this means that you're inflation-proofing your future expenses. This is really valuable to people who are about to retire or to other people that are just trying to flatten out their expenses. Fairbanks and the villages all use diesel to power their – to create energy. The price of diesel went from $3.70 at the beginning of February to $5.07 in the last couple of days. So villages, which are 100% diesel, are going to be hit hard. Fairbanks is going to be hit very hard with this. And I don't know what's going to happen with natural gas prices, but volatility is becoming greater. In the news today, a utility was told by the Nevada utility, this Lake Tahoe utility, was told, we are cutting off 75% of your power that we've been providing. We're going to cut it off next year. And that was because they had started to build data centers, and they were – the Nevada company couldn't support that. They probably can't support their own needs. As I talked to the governor, he was 2 years ago, he was saying data centers and the increasing demand for electricity – is going to make things – really mix things up. We need more energy sources to deal with the greater demand. And so I think that is coming true, and it's adding to the volatility. And I would hope that solar customers would be allowed the way to dodge some of those bullets that are coming at them. So, I hit the freedom of choice – I think we all understand that as Alaskans. Some people want to DIY their own solar. They don't have to go to a solar company. And it's, you know, they want to be able to put solar on their own roof. And I wanted to point out as well the benefit of having diversified sources, including solar. And that is that with this bill, more people will go solar. They'll make most of their power and save more electrons during the summer, of course. The gas, there'll therefore be more gas left in the ground in Cook Inlet, and consequently the price of gas will be lower incrementally as we add solar. So I see it as customers are saving money. It's mirrored by what's happening in the greater society, that gas is being prices are being kept down. We have less LNG that we're going to need to buy. And so I think that's a greater good for it's a win-win in multiple directions. Finally, I want to give a shout-out to my crew. Great people, young people, dedicated, mission-driven. I don't have a lot of trouble hiring people. People want to work in the solar industry. And I'm able to do decent wages with some benefits and kind of carry some of the people through the winter. These are jobs that young Alaskans want. It helps them stick around. It helps them take good care of themselves and family in some cases. So I always want to mention them and how much it matters to them. So, and I'm not alone. This is something that is happening in many companies. So these are real people with real jobs making energy for families who are very pleased to have us on their roof and take care of them. Okay, so rah-rah-rah solar is a catch right now, and that is that with the loss of the investment tax credit, the 30% that people used to get to help with the cost of solar, now a middle-class family is going to look at this potential investment and give them a proposal, and it's going to be 5 or 6% return on investment. Most people's reaction to that is meh, not so great. So most people aren't going to do this. We've reduced choices for middle-class people at that point. It becomes only that something that people in the higher socioeconomic areas can access. And so one of the big points I want to make here is that if we want solar to go forward, the annual net metering is a no-cost way or very low-cost way to the state to drive a lot of private capital into energy production and gas savings. The money comes from customers. The majority of the money for this is going to come from customers who want to put it on their own house. And because of that, they'll, through the miracle of solar, you put it out in the sun, and it makes energy. And people are psyched about that. And so with annual net metering, we'll be back up around 7-8%. That's at the stock market. I know from my experience in 10 years, this is where it needs to be in order for residential customers to go forward with it. So it's really needed to get that private capital going. Finally, there's been a lot of discussion about the cross-subsidy issue. I would definitely like to take – it's complex. I think the committee and later in the process, there's going to be solutions to this. I hope there will be. I think we all care about it and want to solve it. I want to point out the scale of it mostly at this point. Remember how to do this? Okay, so we all feel some kinship with Hawaii, late statehood thing. It's easy to fly there in 5 or 6 hours. So it kind of feels like a sibling state to us. But in solar, it's more like a second cousin. And I want to show you why. So I'm going to use the cursor here. I don't know if that's helpful to people, but I want to point out here, bottom left, at the amount of solar that's coming, or amount of electricity that's coming from solar in Hawaii is 24%. Pretty big. 37% over here on the other side. 37% of Hawaiian homes have solar. That's pretty incredible. Drive down the road, more than a third have solar on it. Why was that? Because their electricity was 40 to 50 cents per kilowatt hour because of the diesel and the expense, the diesel production facilities and the expense of keeping things going in Hawaii. And so you put out a solar panel in Hawaii, it makes a ton of power, lots of sunlight, intense sunlight. It goes there. And it payoff was quick. It drove a lot of money. If you had a roof that worked, you put solar on it if you could. So it took off there, and it got to the point where the penetration was creating issues for the utility, both in terms of keeping the lights on and maintaining a steady supply. I get that. I helped run microgrids in the bush. It's a chore. It takes will to solve those problems. So Yeah, there's an expense there, and it's where things can go. But here in Alaska, we're in a very different boat. So 0.33% of our electricity is coming from solar. 4.5% of our homes have solar. That means the people who do have solar have much smaller systems than the ones in Hawaii. So the cross-subsidy issue is really small to nothing. I really think it's kind of like a mouse casting a big shadow. Unfortunately, we don't have numbers for what the cost is, and we really need those numbers, and we need to have a mechanism of creating that. And I think there's solutions coming that will hopefully address that. But the main point I want to make is that the adoption of solar in Alaska has been slow, and it will continue to be moderate. The profitability of it is moderate, so the uptake is going to be moderate. So thank you to everyone. Glad to take questions and to discuss.
Thank you very much, Mr. May. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. May, for your meeting yesterday with me and for your presentation just now. But in the beginning of your presentation, you made a statement, and it said, you said residential customers don't follow the law. And I really would appreciate, not just for me, but for those that may be watching, could you please clarify what you meant by that statement? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, maybe I misspoke there. What I meant is that commercial and utility customers are aware and maybe lobbying and maybe trying to see that they get their interests met. Residential customers, they come to someone like me, and they are just the receivers of, oh, this is the situation. And they, you know, people coming to me 3 months from now will have no idea what happened here. So that was, I guess, my point. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Senator Yunt.
Thank you, through the chair to the presenter. Lots of great information. Quick question about some safety stuff. So power's out, windstorm, you know, still maybe sunny. Mm-hmm. And the system shut down. Our linemen are out there working on them, and power may or may not be backflowing into the system. How does that look? How does that work?
Right. Thank you for the question, Senator Yund, and through the chair, and my apologies for not doing that before. Learning. So, okay. This has been a prime question that many people look at. It's the inverters, microinverters that we use of all kinds perceive grid power, and if that goes down, it is out within 20 to 30 milliseconds. This is all UL listed, and there's new UL listing coming that will update that. It's all UL 1741, I believe. And they're all the inverters have that, and this is to protect firemen and linemen for the utilities. In addition, when somebody walks up to a system, there's always a disconnect where somebody can manually close that, so they feel it's mostly psychological protection, but it really like shuts everything down. There's an open gap where they cannot. So if a worker wants to add safety, they can do that.
Follow up, Senator Yunt.
Thank you, sir. Through the chair, so can we talk about potential unintended consequences of, you know, I go and get a system on my roof, and now you get enough of those out there, it may or may not affect the business model for the local utility companies such as MEA, Chuyak, others, right?
Right.
And so what does my system do to my neighbor's bill in the long run if he doesn't have the same, you know, amount of extra money laying around to get a system as well?
Excellent question, through the chair. This is the essence of the cross-subsidy issue. And at a basic level, when somebody buys less power, then people who are buying more power have to maintain more of the grid. Right. So, they pay the fixed costs of the grid. So this is something that I would probably say all states in the U.S. and in the world are grappling with and trying to find good solutions. I'm very sensitive to the issue. I don't want solar to make people who don't have solar have more expensive power. There are amendments. I don't know if you want to talk about House amendments, but there's an amendment that would have a threshold where once a certain amount of expense is being put onto a very low bar, 2% more expense being put onto solar have-nots, then the utility goes to the RCA, they present their numbers, the RCA checks the numbers, we say we'd like to take these costs and put them onto the solar customers. I think that's a very fair way to do it. It's been something similar has been done in Nevada where when somebody injects power from their solar into the grid, they get 88 or 95% of that value. When they buy power, then they have to pay 100%. So they're always paying a little bit for their use of the grid and paying for the fixed costs. And if we do that with between the utilities and the RCA, then you have a numbers that are generated, vetted by the RCA, that have some basis. And then we finally have numbers to this issue. We've talked about this issue since 2010, and it hasn't been really addressed.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Senator Young.
Final question. So, I'm not picking on you. I'm not an anti-solar guy. I'm indifferent on it. Hawaii is an example, but I think it would be a stretch to use it as a great one, just based on the fact that they use the bulk of their power in the summer when they need more air conditioning. Right. And for them, their seasons are pretty similar. But here in our state, we use the bulk of our power in the winter when we don't get as much benefit. So can you speak to storage systems, battery banks, the technology in that regard, how is hopefully improving and ways that Alaskans could actually benefit more at the time we need it the most?
Well, through the chair, that's a heavy lift. Storage, seasonal storage is a heavy lift. I think pumped hydro is probably the most likely to have some benefit. I would say that we're still using power in the summer. And so to save natural gas in the summer is a help to the greater society by not getting into that scarcity as quickly. That is the main benefit I can see at this point. And I'm realistic. Solar is one of the solutions. Wind is also a very good solution, and batteries help all these things work. Both of those are providing cheaper power that's installed more quickly than other means in order to meet this deficit. And so it takes a suite of solutions to make this go.
Thank you. Wind is a great option if you don't like birds. So if I had to pick between the two, I would choose solar, but I'll leave it
great.
At that. Thank you.
That works for me.
Mr. May, I have a question. We discussed kind of this trigger point of percentage where the RCA would take a look at some kind of differential rate for net metering customers. If we had to put a number on it now with the amount of solar folks that are currently net metering under the monthly net metering,
right,
what would that number be on that same scale now?
So the cost of paying for the difference between the monthly net metering now and the annual net metering that we're doing with current customers that are connected, it would be $300,000. The governor has already given $1 million to AEA. They hope to use that towards paying this difference for a few years until things get going. So, I think that is the difference in cost between annual and net metering. I think the cost is very small. If I can use myself as an example, I put lots of solar in my house, of course, and then I bought an EV and two heat pumps. My bill went up. I'm electrifying my house. Oh, I have an induction stove too. My bill went up. Erin, blanking her name, she was on the HEA board. She did great research. One third of the savings that was expected from solar companies is actually being realized. People are consuming more when they put solar in their house. They're doing more things with it. And so as a result, the load on people who don't have solar is diminished.
Understood. Yeah. Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
No, I'm all right.
That's okay. Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. May. We have other folks that are going to testify, and so we're going to go to them now. Next up for invited testifiers, we have Mr. Rob Montgomery. Mr. Montgomery, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony, that would be most excellent.
Yes, sir. Thank you. For the record, my name is Rob Montgomery. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Homer Electric Association. I am joined by our Regulatory Affairs Manager, J.D. Draves, and so he's here with me as well. Through the chair, I just want to say we at first appreciate the opportunity to testify before your committee. Also want to say that we appreciate the work that is being done by the governor and his team, as well as the legislature, as we look to increase net metering opportunities for residents across Alaska. As a member-owned utility, you know, we have a responsibility to offer our members what we think are value-added programs and services. And we see net metering being that type of program, and it is one that we're pleased to offer. In our current form, our net metering program began in 2010, and we're pleased to say that today we have 658 net metering members on our system. Now, that's not to say that we don't have a few concerns with some of the language in the bill. A few of the concerns we have, the first would be the cost shifting or the shifting of cost. I know that is something this committee was speaking about in a previous meeting, but this is where the cost for the ongoing maintenance of the local grid shift over to non-net metering customers. So that would be one concern. Another concern is the potential cost that could be incurred by the utility for various bill programming, as well as other administrative duties. You know, we're a small utility. If you look at us on the Rail Belt, we're the smallest cooperative, and we have approximately 13 members per mile. To put some perspective on that, a utility like Chugach Electric, they're closer to 70 members per mile. So we are certainly much smaller. So when we have additional cost, it can certainly have an impact on our utility. And then we also have a question, you know, what happens if this state funded program is not fully funded at some point in the future? So that's one of the things that we would have a concern about. So I guess, you know, to summarize, do we oppose this legislation? No, we don't. Do we have some concerns that we would like to see addressed further? Yes, we do. Are we open to new rate structures that would eliminate the need for a general fund? Yes, we would be open to those conversations. And, you know, would we like to see the technology improve to the point where net metering power can be stored by our members and dispatched when needed? And, of course, the answer to that is yes as well. Keeping in mind, this is the value proposition where a dispatchable electron is worth more to the co-op than, and it should be compensated accordingly. You know, for ATA, the bottom line is we work hard to be responsive to our members, and net metering, you know, is a good fit, especially given the type of communities we serve. They're more rural in nature, more spread out, and do not have the access to some different programs that you may have in more urban areas. So that concludes my testimony, and be glad to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Montgomery. I have one question. What differences do you expect as far as billing and administrative costs to exist from a shift to annual net metering as opposed to the monthly net metering that you all currently do?
Through the chair, a lot of it's going to be more software related, and we're going to have to reset through our programming the nature of the billing and what we're doing. Is it something that could be done? Yes. Is it going to cost us probably some money to do so? Yes, it would. But it would be more software and IT related.
Understood. Very good. Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, we will go next to Ms. Julie Etsy with the Matanuska Electrical Association.
Hello, Chair Dirkman. Thank you and committee members for allowing me to testify on Senate Bill 150. For the record, my name is Julie Etsy. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at Matanuska Electric Association. We serve a large service territory that goes from Eagle River up to Denali State Park and across to Glacier View. The railroad utilities are currently navigating a quickly shifting landscape, both globally and locally. It's a time of unprecedented change as we transition away from certain local Cook Inlet fuel towards a new future that we're still trying to define. NEA supports the governor's proactive approach to identifying opportunities during this transition. Increasing the number of individual members, producing a portion of their power behind the meter can indeed be helpful during this transition. Previous testifier Ben gave some great examples of what those opportunities are. We have the opportunity to reduce the gas we burn. We have the opportunity for consumers to participate in energy solutions of the future. And we have the opportunity to reduce consumer bills. Now, MEA, another point that I'd like to make is net metering statute and regulations do exist now, as Mr. Montgomery indicated. All of the regulated rail belt utilities have an active net metering program, and MEA's is 600 members strong and growing, it seems like, daily. We have all kinds of people who are net metering. Some are doing it to reduce their cost. Some are doing it for environmental or conservation reasons. And others are prepping for an uncertain future. And so we do have a variety of people doing this for a variety of reasons. And as Mr. Montgomery mentioned, it is an important part of the offerings we have for our members. And reducing consumer bills, there's been some conversation around that in the gallery today and in the past. And just as an aside, reducing consumer bills is definitely a priority of MEA and really all the utilities I've spoken with. But I think it's important to note that lowering specific member bills does not mean that you're reducing the costs that it takes to provide power to the rest of the membership. And until the RCA is able to provide flexibility to co-ops on rate structures, When a co-op reduces bills for one group of members, the costs of delivering power to the other members don't change, which means the burden to other members only increases. And that's because MEA still needs to stand ready to serve the full power needs of any member whenever they may need us. In Mr. May's testimony, he mentioned that, you know, our members have a right to produce this power, and he's absolutely correct. And some folks in our service territory choose to actually what they call defect from the grid, and they're not connected to MEA. We do not have any obligation to serve them unless they want to reconnect us. But while our net metering members are still connected, we need to be there when they either don't have the power coming through their system, or if they produce almost too much power and need to sell that power back to MEA to use as an asset to the rest of our members. And as a co-op, we can't provide that for free unless the other members pick up the burden. So it's just something to keep in mind as we're having this discussion. Hawaii is a great example. There was a recent policy tour there this past fall. It was incredibly inspiring to see what the state of Hawaii does. And they've also learned some important lessons. In fact, one of the things we learned about their net metering program is that the subsidizing is significant enough that they're now trying to figure out how to adjust their existing system. So we have the opportunity to learn from their lessons and craft something that really works for Alaska. Now, utilities have a little bit of a complicated relationship with net metering. As I said, there are absolute benefits, not only to our members, but also for us to offset gas use and utilize other generation to serve our members, both from a power need as well as it can help with reliability. But we also see that impact to the broader membership that are not net metering. Just to do a brief little nerd out on how rates work, at a co-op, there's basically a couple different ways that we pay the bills that it takes to produce power. The first is called the cost of power adjustment, and that is really just a pass-through cost of the gas that it, gas or fuel or other purchased power that it costs to serve you. Then there's an element that's usually either a combination of base rates, like a per kilowatt hour charge or a fixed charge that's based on the cost to deliver. Again, because the reason why we talk about the subsidy, just to put a finer point on it, is when net metering members are not using, are offsetting a portion of their power, then they don't pay the full freight of the costs to deliver that to members. So currently, when we pay them back at avoided cost, we're paying them for the power that it would cost for us to produce that power somewhere else, like at our power plants, or say at the solar farm down the street. So this bill changes us paying that avoided cost to paying out full retail. So just as full disclosure, I recently this fall moved into a home that already had solar panels installed, and so I am a net metering member. I will benefit from this bill, so I do think that's important to state out loud what folks' conflicts may be with this bill. And NEA has actually done some numbers. I know Mr. May said we're still trying to figure out the numbers of that subsidy, and it's around $50. So, you know, on average per month, me offsetting my power with my net metering system needs to be absorbed by my neighbors. $50 just for me needs to be absorbed by my members. And so that's something that MEA is really closely watching because, again, we really want to take advantage of this. But what mechanisms are in place that we can start offsetting some of those downsides and start really being able to focus on the upsides of net metering? And we think the governor has done a great job of putting some of those components in this bill because we recognize the value. We really applaud the governor for understanding some of these more complex and nuances and for wanting to protect consumers by creating the fund that helps to make the rest of our members whole. So we appreciate the fund component here, but we also recognize that those general fund dollars may not be available at all times, and because our members will be making economic decisions that require years of payoff, creating certainty around that fund would be preferred. We also appreciate the provision in the bill that says painful retail is not required unless the fund is in place. But again, that sends a complicated message to our members who want to make investments, and we would like to be able to provide more continuity so they can make those decisions. We're also aware of previous suggestions from certain utilities that the fund and reimbursement be done directly through either AEA's PCE portal or maybe better through AHFC, where members could send in their bills and be reimbursed rather than through the utility to decrease some of those administrative costs that would inevitably fall on members. So, you just asked Senator Bjorkman a few questions of Mr. Montgomery. NEA ran some numbers on the two options that it would take to make this happen through the NEA billing system. One is to change the system, so to change the software. It costs about $20,000 and takes about 8 to 12 months because we're using an outside group that we need to get into a queue and really mock up. So there's a process there. Or we can do a manual adjustment, which is about a half of an FTE, so half of somebody's job. And each utility would need to create this extra capacity where centralizing it perhaps at one state agency would require much less expense to administer the project. So just as a consideration as we're looking at perhaps the next iteration of the bill. Moving to the subsidy, the fund really only handles the change in bill from if we pay from avoided cost to retail. And it really misses that $50 subsidy I spoke about earlier. As a net metering member myself, I didn't understand that my system was costing other members money, and I'm not sure others do either. We'd recommend changes to the bill that would require utilities to adopt new rate structures that could properly collect associated costs of net metering members to reduce or eliminate that subsidy. The bill currently has some language on lines 5 to 7 of page 2, but it's somewhat confusing and should be more clearly articulated. It also refers to an innovative residential rate, and we recommend changing that to alternative rate structures so it may be more broadly applied to our small businesses that are also invested in net metering. NEA feels like this could be the single biggest change the legislature could do to encourage the adoption of net metering because it eliminates that natural tension for the utility that I spoke of earlier between net metering and non-net metering members so that it removes the subsidy. And this is the biggest area of resistance for broader utility adoption and something that appears but could be clarified in this bill. So we can't speak highly enough of that. Finally, we talked about the benefits of expanding the net metering program, and we think it's important to incentivize the right thing. Encouraging members to overbuild systems and put power on the Alaska grid when we need it the least and is harder to manage, which is the middle of a summer day, is less helpful to solving Alaska's challenges. Also, the difference between avoided costs and full retail at NEA, at least, is almost 2.5 times. So as a net metering member, I don't think the rest of the members should necessarily have to pay 2.5 times for my power than they do from the power plant or even the solar farm in Houston, unless it's actually more valuable to the rest of that membership. You could solve both of these issues by providing the utility with additional options and flexibility to manage that. For instance, you could have the full retail be in conjunction with time of use rates. So NEA could incentivize members to install, say, battery systems or EVs or heat pumps to absorb that excess energy in the middle of the day and instead offset their energy use during peak evening times, which would be an asset to the entire membership and more worthy of additional compensation. The current version of the bill on page 2, line 8, attempts to do that, but it is a little bit confusing in the language and unclear from how we would maybe execute that from a tariff standpoint. So we look forward to providing amendments that could clarify that better. Again, NEA applauds the governor for this proactive approach to contribute a solution as we work through the transitionary energy issues. We appreciate the time and attention this committee has given to understanding and improving the bill. We believe that a few small and surgical changes could really provide net metering as a stronger asset and encourage bigger adoption for the broader membership. We stand ready to answer questions and working with the committee to fine-tune the bill so it can be ready to move through the legislative process. And that concludes my testimony, Chair Bjorkman. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Estee. Any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, at this time we'll open public testimony on Senate Bill 150. Testimony will be limited to 2 minutes. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to this item? We'll go online to Ben Bodiger. Mr. Bodiger, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, I'm Ben Bodiger. I'm an energy policy analyst for Cook Inlet Keeper. And we support the annual net metering structure that would be creating SB 150, making it easier for Alaskans to invest in meeting their own energy needs. This is especially beneficial with the increasing gas costs that we know are going to raise electrical bills. And you've heard annual net metering described as a cross-subsidy that would exacerbate disparities in rates by shifting the distribution of fixed costs. And I'll point out that because we recover the fixed cost of the electrical grid through rates based on power that members consume, there are many things we already accept that can be described as cross-subsidies. It costs the same amount to utilities to keep electrical poles and wires standing, regardless of how much electricity households buy. So it's inevitable that some homes pay a greater share of the fixed costs, and some homes contribute more to fixed costs. For instance, households that are farther from electrical substations require more miles of poles and wires to serve them, and the cost of maintaining those miles are distributed in the rates that every member pays. That can be described as a cross-subsidy just as much as the shift resulting from net metering, but no one would argue that the benefit of allowing people to receive electricity wherever they choose to live outweighs the cost to other ratepayers who have to pay more for the longer power lines of people living farther from substations. Likewise, I think there should be a broader conversation about the benefits of annual net metering, weighed against the potential for redistribution of fixed costs, which are already unequally distributed. Ms. Estee threw out a number of $50 a month for the amount of this cost shifting, and I hope MEA will elaborate in some venue or another on how they reach that number. But we think weighed against that cost, whatever it may be, should be the benefits of allowing Alaskan households to hedge against rising gas costs, and of supporting the Alaska-owned solar installation businesses, such as Mr. Mays. So thank you for taking my testimony and for considering this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, we'll go next to Mr. Paul Seaton. Mr. Seaton, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Paul Seaton. I live in Homer and I'm representing myself. I support SB 150 and I agree with the detailed testimony research project that was submitted by Aaron McKittrick. I believe the major effect on the electrical system is that installations will be made larger kilowatt capacity, and that's because the credits can be rolled forward to following months, and consumers will want to maximize their bill reduction. Since actual production can't be specifically determined, the tendency will be to make sure you have enough, which would be above the annual usage, which ends March 31st. I believe that is a good target date because it's at the end of the winter season when most could be used. The benefit is the reduction of the generator fuel required on an annual basis, and I don't believe that the state should pay the utility for any loss of revenue from encouraging home weatherization to use less fuel, or from net metering, which encourages the use of less fuel. So the payment under Section 4205.395D
or creation of the fund is not really necessary. If that remains, I suggest adding a provision that the utility loss can only be computed from the difference of the average projected current net metering to the projected annual sales with annual net metering. And additionally, I'd like you to recognize that on 4205-395-A2, unused credits expire should be incorporated into any calculation of loss to the load-serving entity. All those credit kilowatts will be free to the utility and were sold during that year at a retail price to users on the system with no generating fuel cost at all. So it serves as an offset to any perceived loss. And thank you for taking my testimony today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Seaton. Is there anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Mr. Draves, did you have public testimony that you would like to give in addition to Mr. Montgomery? Just wanted to check.
Excuse me. Sorry about that. Good afternoon for the record. This is G.D. Draves, Manager of Regulatory Affairs and Rate Design at Homer Electric. And I just want to thank you again for the opportunity for allowing me to testify. At this point, I have nothing further to offer, and thank you again.
Thank you, sir. This time we'll hold public testimony open, as we'll hear this bill further at a future meeting. I have one question for Commissioner DeVries. Commissioner DeVries, as you would evaluate a different rate, possibly between the retail cost or the avoided cost from a net metering customer, how would the RCA go about assigning a fair number between those two numbers? What would the measurements and value judgments made by the RCA be in order to come up with that figure?
Through the chair, Senator Bjornquist, this is Steve DeVries. For the record, I'm a commissioner with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I'm here to testify on HB 180. We have Chair Espindola and Claire Knutson are available to answer the specific questions on SB 150. So I would defer to them. If that's okay.
Most excellently, sir. Thank you. Commissioner Espindola, could you answer that question, please?
For the record, this is Chair Espindola from the Regulatory Commission. And I'm sorry, Senator Bjorkman, we were thrown off when you deferred to Commissioner DeVries for SB 150. Would you kindly repeat that question for us?
Yep. No problem. No trouble at all. The question is, how will the RCA decide and what metrics, judgments, and valuations would you decide on when calculating a rate for net metering, a tariff that is between the retail rate and the avoided cost rate? How would you make that judgment?
For the record, and through this is Claire Knutson-Latta, through the chair, I'll briefly touch on how we calculate it now because that may answer part of your question. Currently, we calculate what's called a SFPPR rate, Small Firm Purchase Power Rate, it's part of the calculation of the COPA. We use the utility's existing costs and existing sales to determine what that SFPPR rate should be. Presumably, as we sort of look at how would like a new rate calculated, we would take into account any additional costs sought to be included by the legislature.
Okay.
Okay.
That's helpful. Are there any other questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, we appreciate everyone being available today and committee members' attention to this matter. We'll set Senate Bill 150 aside for further consideration at a future meeting. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. It's 2:54 p.m. here in Senate Labor and Commerce. After a thrilling hearing all about electrons, we're going a little bit upstream of the generation, and we'll talk about natural gas just a bit. We have Senate Bill 180 with us to provide a recap of the bill. Is Senator Geisel and her staff, Paige Brown. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your names for the record and begin your brief recap.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Kathy Geisel, representing Senate District E. Mr. Chairman, utility regulation is almost as complicated as healthcare regulation. Senate Bill 180 clarifies the authority of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska regulates rates for utilities to protect consumers. This bill speaks to a bill that was passed 2 years ago called House Bill 50. On page 37 of House Bill 50, lines 27 through 29, a sentence was added that implies that the Regulatory Commission of Alaska has no regulatory authority over LNG facilities, that they are under the Federal Regulatory Commission and Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That's an absolutely true statement, Mr. Chairman. However, it's been confused. People believe that that sentence means the RCA, Regulatory Commission of Alaska, has no jurisdiction over the rates for the product coming out of an LNG facility. In a recent docket last year, the docket I'm referring to, you have in your packet, U25004, on page 18, identifies the U.S. statute, the U.S. code, 15 U.S.C. 717BE1, states that FERC, quote, shall have the exclusive authority to approve or deny application for siting, construction, expansion, or operation of an LNG facility. No one debates that. However, the confusion from the sentence in HB 50 has caused some consumers and even perhaps utilities to believe that that means the RCA cannot regulate the price of the gas that comes out of the utility that takes that gas. But, Mr. Chairman, it's no different than a utility such as NSTAR receiving gas from an offshore platform. The purpose of this bill is to remove the confusing sentence, and that's why the bill, which is exceedingly short, simply does that, removes the confusing sentence that was placed in HB 50. There is no legislative history as to why that sentence was added or even who added it. So with that, Mr. Chairman, RCA Commissioner Steve DeVries is available to speak to this issue.
Thank you very much, Senator Geisel. Before we go to Mr. DeVries, are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing none, I have a question for you, Commissioner DeVries. Could you please explain for the committee and the public how things would change from your position as an RCA commissioner with the implementation of this bill?
For the record, my name is Steve DeVries. I'm a commissioner with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. To answer your question succinctly, things don't change at all. What this bill does is it removes the ambiguity that Senator Geisel spoke to. If that's the short answer, I can give you a much longer answer by way of an explanation if you'd like.
The answer you gave is perfect. It was the right length. Any further questions? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, we will now open it public testimony on Senate Bill 180. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? We have one person online waiting to testify. We'll go now to Lynn Willis. Please put your name and affiliation on the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Lynn Willis. I'm calling from Eagle River representing myself. Yeah, as the senator said, this does have a rather lofty title that is very specific, albeit important, to clarify consumer protection over an import facility. I'm concerned about which import facility. We now have an effort to have two of them. One is apparently NSTAR and Glenfarne versus, I should know versus is the right word, but as opposed to Hillcorp and its utilities, electrical utilities, we want to use it that way. I think that's going to be a problem if and deciding which one will get the go-ahead. And I'm not sure FERC would be necessarily interested in consumer protection as much as the RCA would be. But that needs to be resolved. We also have the time factor. I'm glad that we have almost made it through an extremely cold winter and didn't have to get any of the warnings or shutdowns or any of that stuff. But it doesn't look like we're going to go back to Cook Inlet to get gas. And this might be a little far afield, but based on the recent bids in both the federal and the state leases, I think there was one for the state and none for the federal. So importation is the way we're going to go. I don't know about the customer base for this import facility. Are we going to try to expand it to include the rail belt, Donlin Mine? Someone has mentioned today data processing center. That might be a good customer for more gas. The railroad has a DOT permit now to move LNG on rail. We did a modular system. Could we move gas or propane beyond the end of the rail belt or down the rivers or around the coast on barges? I don't know if you want to expand the customer base. And another thing is, where will this gas, where is it going to be purchased? I guess Kitimat would be the closest. I don't know. I'd certainly be on my pay grade to decide. But we also have to then start looking at what kind of contracts. I don't know if you really want to try to rely on the spot market. And I can hardly see a bulk LNG carrier moving into Cook Inlet to give us a portion, a tiny portion of its cargo.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Willis. So, your 2 minutes have expired. We appreciate you. Thank you for joining us today. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Seeing and hearing none, at this time we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 180. That brings Senate Bill 180 back before the committee. Members have in their packets a sponsored blank committee substitute for Senate Bill 180. May I have a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 180, version 34-Lima Sierra 0819-N as in Northern, as a working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. The changes in the CS simply allow for an immediate effective date, so that's the explanation. Is there any objection to that committee substitute being adopted? Hearing and seeing no objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 180, version 34-LS0819-N, as in Nikiski, is adopted as a working document. Is there any further discussion, comments, questions about Senate Bill 180? Hearing and seeing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to report Senate Bill 180, version 34-Lima Sierra 0819-N, as in Northern, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, Senate Bill 180, version 34-LS0819-N, as in Kiske, is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Please stick around after the meeting to sign the committee report. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. It's 3:04 now in Belt's room 105. Finally, today, we found the bill that we've all been waiting for. It's Senate Bill 196, dealing with behavioral health surcharge and fund. With us here to present the bill, we have the Honorable Senator Scott Kawasaki and his trusty staff, Ms. Jenna Calhoun. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your names and affiliation for the record and begin your brief recap of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, Scott Kawasaki, Senator for District P, Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and Badger.
Jenna Calhoun, staff for Senator Kawasaki, for the record.
And just to be very brief, Mr. Chairman, just wanted to say that we've been trying to set up a real stable, substantial funding stream to be able to help pay specifically for the 988 fund. The 988 is something that started probably 5 years ago now under the Biden administration. It was most recently funded through federal grants and federal systems. A lot of states have enjoyed having the 988 number, as we've seen even growth here in the state of Alaska up near over 100% as far as call volume goes. 988 is one of those numbers that when a person feels like they are suicidal or have other issues relating to a mental health issue, they can contact 988 directly. That line goes directly to a person who is able to intake them and try and talk to them, help them cope, help them find resources that they might otherwise need. So 988, of course, has been a very valuable part of this behavioral health crisis sort of continuum that we have in the state. It's but it again, we're without the federal funding, we have to find funds to replace the lack of those federal funds. And so we're hoping that this, whatever the surcharge looks like, is able to fully fund the system running forward. Right now it's been placed as a monthly surcharge on wireless and wired telephones, similar to the 911, enhanced 911 surcharge that was placed on phones to create the 911 system. And that's all I have for now.
Thank you very much, Senator Kawasaki. Are there any questions from committee members? Hearing and seeing no questions at this time on Senate Bill 196, we'll open public testimony on this item. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify? We have one person online who wishes to testify. Her name is Jan Caulfield. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Jan Caulfield. I live in Juneau and calling in strong support for this bill. And personal experience, my father died by suicide in 1957. I'm pretty sure at that point there were no numbers for him to call. 20 years later, I had a college roommate who attempted suicide in 1977, and, you know, she would have had to look up quite a long number to contact for support, and she did do that, and that provided time for her, and luckily I came home and was able to intervene and get her to the hospital. And, you know, I know that we all heard this week, or many of us heard this week from students from Tuxedo Bay, from Night Newt, from the Bethel area about the importance of this bill to them and to and its support by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and that sort of thing. So just simply put, strong supporter of this bill and a consistent funding source provided by Alaskans to take care of Alaskans. So thank you for listening to my comment.
Thank you very much, Ms. Caulfield. Is there anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing none, we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 196. That brings Senate Bill 196 back before the committee. I had prepared a draft committee substitute for this item. It would basically change the fund source for the Behavioral Services Fund to a tax on essentially social media companies and the ads that they sell. However, that is an option. At this time, though, it is not expedient for the bill's progression forward, and so we'll continue to consider that as a legislative option in the future. So we will not be adopting the CS at this time. So as we look to, though, the possibility, I think, of having something that causes cost for behavioral health needs as something like social media, as we all kind of know, does, to have that cost causer be the cost payer, I think might be a worthy goal in the future. I did have a chance to look over my paper statement that I really like for my phone bill, which is a landline, which are going away too often, I think, because of the increased cost. And so the taxes and fees and kind of surcharges on that bill are almost $20, or encroaching on $20 as a portion of about a $72 bill per month for one landline. And so I think that's something as a policy matter we might take into account as well when we talk about different fees on lines. And I really like my landline. It's an important safety thing that I feel strongly about in my house, because my kids can operate it when the power's out. It's always there. It's big and red, and so it's easy to notice. And so I enjoy it, and I feel like it's a good deal. So I'm just kind of interested in how much a fee like this would continue to add on to the other fees that you see on telephone bills. So, but we'll keep her moving here, and we'll not offer the CS to change that fund source at this time. Is there any other questions or comments in regards to this bill? Senator Yount.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, thank you. Yeah, I think this is a grand starting point, a good idea. There are a lot of unintended consequences from social media use. My question is there a way to – would there be a way to – help pay for after-school activities and all the other funds and the different things that we're trying to do to help keep kids on the right track and keep them active and all the other things that lead to not being depressed and different things like that. I mean, just maybe something to explore and think about, and then, you know, you'd have my full support on moving the decibel point over by 1 to 2. You know, you can move the decibel point over 1 or 2 times if you'd like, and you'll still have my support. So I'll leave it at that.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I'm not sure if it was really a question, but what this would do is set up in place a fund. The fund would be used for behavioral health services, but primarily the 988 fund would take the bulk of that amount, depending upon how many landlines and how many cell phone lines there are within the state. I will also say that, just to address some of the comments earlier, is that, you know, the state's becoming more online. You're getting a lot more voice over IP phones rather than actual fixed landlines. You're getting a lot more cellular connections, or it's becoming all very digital very quickly. In fact, just earlier this week, the federal government announced that the state of Alaska would receive $630 million of federal funding for about a dozen companies within the state. They're all for-profit companies, but these would be receiving funds to be able to increase access to another 50,000 people across the state that normally wouldn't have direct connections. So that's pretty amazing. It's an amazing ability for the federal government to be able to help fund access to rural parts of Alaska. We're hoping that, you know, companies will see this as one of those benefits that will be conferred to everybody equally, and that they will stand in support of something like this enhanced 988 funding, and also be able to use it for other types of things like you're talking about, Senator Yount.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. Senator Kawasaki, I support it 100%. Can you estimate how much revenue do you think this would generate?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, according to the fiscal analysis, it was roughly $6 to $8 million based on a certain number of phone lines, and then so that was the average guess. If it was at a 98 cent, which is what is established in Senate Bill 96.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, can I follow up?
Yes.
And to you, Mr. Chairman, I'd love to see your bill that has $20 worth of fees on it. after the meeting. I just thought I'd mention that. But anyway, it's just a really, really important bill, and I look forward to seeing it making it to the finish line. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yep, we have the bills. We have copies of my bill right over there. Mr. Jackson has. You can take a look at those. All right. Is there any further discussion on this item? Seeing, hearing none, what are the wishes of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move to report Senate Bill 196, version 34, Lima, Sierra 0926, /I as an individual from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any objection? Hearing and seeing none, committee substitute for Senate Bill 196, version 34-LS0926, /I as in Indiana, is moved from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Please stay after the committee meeting to sign the committee report. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Monday next week when we will take up Senate Bill 244, Travel Insurance, Senate Bill 225, Trust, Trustee Proceedings and Trustees, and Senate Bill 217, Employer Contributions. Senate Bill 185 is removed from the agenda for Monday because we dispense with that bill today. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee today, we are adjourned at 3:16 p.m.